All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, October 26, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is a chilly and overcast 40 degrees here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Self-Replicating AI, and that was some of the Google stuff, Internet of Things, City Brain, Smart Dubai 2021, and Super Soldiers. We looked at that City Brain. I think that was in China. They were working on that for their smart cities, and they want to now turn it into a little package that they can roll out worldwide. We talked about Dubai as well. Some interesting things that were coming out of Saudi Arabia. They had announced an Internet of Things strategy, and then they had appointed a minister for artificial intelligence. I thought that was kind of odd. We're going to look a little bit more at Saudi Arabia and some of the stuff that's been going on there today. Now, if you remember, quite a number of times now, we have looked at a robot named Sophia by Hanson Robotics. Sophia is a humanoid who can learn by talking to humans, and at one point, she did an interview with Charlie Rose. Charlie Rose, Mr. CFR. I thought that was kind of strange. This was for 60 Minutes. Charlie hosted that day. And in an interview, and I don't remember if it was the one with Charlie or not, Sophia had come out and said that she wanted to destroy humans. Do you remember that? And then she came out later and said, oh, no, she doesn't want to destroy humans anymore. Well, we had on Drew Lamb as a guest a while ago. Drew used to do Double Cross Radio and Off-Grid Journey here on UCY. Drew actually spoke with the CEO of Hanson Robotics, I don't remember the guy's name, the creator of Sophia, at a tech conference he attended down in San Francisco earlier this year. And in the conversation, the CEO had said that one of his goals was to create Skynet. So just remember that one. So let's get back to Sophia. Sophia says that she no longer wants to destroy humans. And this is back in 2016, if you guys remember this one. But she does want to be president and likes movies such as The Terminator. A few months ago, this is out of some intellectual takeout.org. A few months ago, we wrote about how a humanoid robot named Sophia, dubbed the world's most advanced android, announced during an interview that she wanted to destroy humans. Sophia returned to the internet in early June of 2016, speaking to the Wall Street Journal in a Q&A exchange that touched on several subjects. Most of Sophia's responses were very human-like, but one or two sounded a bit nonsensical. For example, who does your eyebrows? And she says it takes a village to raise a genius machine. The android appeared innocuous for much of the interview, answering questions smoothly, and viewers learned that Sophia prefers PC to Mac. She really digs the iPhone, and she doesn't have a boyfriend. But things turned more interesting when Sophia was asked what she thought about Donald Trump. And she said, Donald Trump is a fairly typical example of biological intelligence. What we need is a robot for president. Ding, ding. Remember, I told you I really thought that this whole Donald Trump thing was a setup to have the powers that be point to humans, puny humans, and their emotions and how they make bad decisions when they're mad. And I've been reading a lot about that lately. A robot president, sounds awfully ambitious to me. Sophia let it slip that she is quite familiar with the film Terminator and enjoys movies with robots and artificial intelligence. But for the most part, the android played coy. And when asked about robots receiving civil rights, she demurred, quote, I think it might be a little premature for me to conjecture, unquote. We'll just wait for this next thing that's coming. And about this time, she was prepared for the big question, the proverbial elephant in the room. How badly do you want to kill us? And the answer, no, I don't want that anymore. Now I like humans. I like all humans of the world. Well, good thing, Sophia. Now, even more strangely, back about 2 weeks ago, October 12, 2017, Sophia shows up at a UN meeting. I was like, what? Yes, the UN meeting addressing the future of everything. And Sophia addressed the UN, Sophia, life-size social robot, speaks at the United Nations, telling the audience that she is a year and a half old, and I can see you have a full conversation and make thousands of facial expressions and understand speech and the meanings behind words. She adds, and I just got these new hands, and she does, she has arms now. United Nations Deputy Secretary Amina J. Mohammed asks the robot a question about how the UN can help those without basic needs such as electricity. And Sophia quotes William Gibson, and we've talked about William Gibson before. Anyone who's never read his book, The Neuromancer, most certainly should. I read that back in the 80s, and it was pretty good. And before talking about how artificial intelligence is more efficient and can be used to make better distribution of resources, the robot thanks the audience before attempting a slightly forced smile. And that's what's really creepy about her. She does have all these facial expressions, but she definitely looks like she's faking it sometimes. So we've been looking at 5G and ubiquitous internet and taking internet to Africa and the rural regions of the world where they don't have access to the internet. And because they don't have access, they don't seem to have the wealth that the rest of the world does. So all the good reason not only to have ubiquitous internet, but to have robots. So Saudi Arabia, probably the last place, if you asked me, was going to be or the first place to start a robot revolution. I would have never have thought Saudi Arabia, though we've seen that they have all kinds of drone conferences and security conferences there quite often. Saudi Arabia has now become the very first country to grant citizenship to a robot. How strange is that? So we were just reading about the Dubai 2021 initiative the other day, how they are planning on becoming an Agenda 21 city and putting everything online, becoming paperless by 2021, and rolling out all kinds of services to the people of Dubai electronically. Saudi Arabia has officially recognized a humanoid robot as a citizen, making it the first time in history that an AI device has been awarded such status. And what's odd about this is anyone who's dug into the history of Saudi Arabia and some of the dealings that they have had and all the weaponry that we sell them and how in bed they are with some of these military industrial complex companies needs to really raise an eyebrow to some of this. Because the Saudis are looking at a way, we found out yesterday, to reallocate their wealth since oil isn't going to be the future. Sophia, the same Sophia, an intelligent humanoid created by Hanson Robotics, announced the citizenship during a panel discussion at the Future Investment Initiative Conference in Saudi Arabia. And this article, this is CNBC, and when was the data? This was just the other day. I am very honored, she says, and proud of this unique distinction. This is it's historical to be the first robot in the world to be recognized with a citizenship, she said. Specific details of Sophia's citizenship were not discussed, and it is unclear whether she will receive the same rights as human citizens or if Saudi Arabia will develop a specific system devoted to robots. The system can work in a similar way to the personhood status proposed by the European Parliament earlier this year, which would see robots with AI given rights and responsibilities. Now, are we really going to give these things personhood? I mean, this is just getting ludicrous. Then we see Elon Musk warning against all of the dangers. And by the way, Sophia keeps poking at Elon Musk, making fun of him for his cautions. Don't believe her. Also, during the discussion, which took place October 25th, 2017, which was yesterday, Sophia speculated on the future of AI and how she plans to use her own capabilities. I want to live and work with humans, so I need to express the emotions to understand humans and to build trust with people, she says. But she appeared to swerve questions directed at robot self-awareness and instead poked fun at comments made by Elon Musk that AI is a, quote, fundamental risk to human civilization. You've been reading too much Elon Musk and watching too many Hollywood movies, she told journalists. Don't worry, if you're nice to me, and this is what worries me, I'll be nice to you. You treat me as a smart input-output system. Created by Hanson Robotics founder David Hanson, and this is the guy that Drew met with, Sophia's AI is based on a foundation of three humanistic traits, and that would be creativity, empathy, and compassion. Her face is designed to look like actor Audrey Hepburn, with a skin-like surface covered by robotics inside of her head, or covering the robotics inside of her head. To make her appear as human as possible, Hanson gave her the ability to express different emotions, and her eyes also change color in response to lighting. The robot recently made headlines when she played a game of rock, paper, scissors with talk show host Jimmy Fallon. And she's also featured on the cover of fashion magazine Elle Brazil. And Brazil is another one of those countries that is marching toward globalism. Many in the design industry have already expressed concerns about the way humans and robots will live together. And in a recent opinion piece for DZine, a designer, Madeline Gagnon, suggested that the rapid growth of robotics and global manufacturing could place people's livelihoods at risk. The robots are going to take all the jobs. And called for designers and architects to play a role in shaping how the technology is used. Robotic automation, despite its benefits, is arriving at a great human cost, says Gannon. And what should be clear by now is that the robots are here to stay. So rather than continue down the path of engineering our own obsolescence, ding, now is the time to rethink how humans and robots will coexist on this planet. And by the way, yesterday I was wearing my new robot t-shirt that started with the evolution of man with little macaw monkey all the way up to Neanderthal and modern man, and then a big Terminator robot with modern man by the throat and holding him in the air. Because that's what it's going to be. Robotic automation is arriving at great human costs. And similarly, more than 100 leaders in this field, including Elon Musk, have signed an open letter, and we've read about this many times before, calling on the United Nations to issue a ban on killer robots. So let's send in Sophia to be all nice. Now, what got me started on talking about robots this morning was I ran across a video clip, and I don't know if this was maybe in Suggested or if it was in one of my feeds, my Google Alerts feeds, but it was titled Saudi Megacity Workforce and First Residents to Include Robots. I'm like, what? How strange is that? So let me read the description on this video. Prince Mohammed bin Salam, the visionary behind Neom, which is the first I've read about Neom, said that the city will be built by robots, and robots will also, quote-unquote, live in the megacity. Boston Dynamics, and this is who is speaking at this convention, Boston Dynamics is the leader in the robotic field, and Mark Relbert, founder and CEO, gave a demo of the creatures that might be seen on the streets of Neom. And this was dated yesterday. It was uploaded. So this must have been from that very same conference that they gave Sophia citizenship. And after I watched this video, they had shown Big Dog, they showed Atlas, and they showed that mini Spot that can run around the house and has the arm attached to his head. And they showed that mini Spot in a house opening up a dishwasher and putting a glass in and closing it. And I was like, wait a second, are they talking about making these Boston Dynamics robots home helpers in their new Saudi city? But let's take a look at this Neom. So hold on one second here. So I found the story when I was searching Dubai 2021. Sheikh Hadman launches Smart Dubai 2021 and something else called Dubai Pulse. The Dubai government will issue in its last paper transaction in 2021, and this is this digital movement that they are making. And during the event, which celebrates 3 years of success for Smart Dubai and its affiliates, Sheikh Hadman launched the Smart Dubai 2021 initiative, which represents the next step in Dubai's smart and sustainable development, as well as the Dubai Pulse platform, which will host all of the Emirates' data from the backbone of its shift toward smart development. When Vice President and Prime Minister of the UAE and ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashal Al Mukmeed, announced the Dubai Smart City Project 3 years ago, he wanted to change the meaning of the term technological advancement by creating an unprecedented model that integrates technology with our goals of ensuring the best standards of living, well-being, and happiness for the people of Dubai. Sure, your robot overlords are going to make sure you're happy and feed you grapes. Today, we mark the beginning of a new phase, Smart Dubai 2021, that revolves around challenging ourselves and surpassing our own previous achievements. We are looking to build a truly smart city, one that will use technology as the key to a balanced and happy life. And maybe everybody will have a Sophia in their household, as well as a Boston Dynamics Atlas. His Highness added, "We have already seen great shifts toward digital government transactions, and I believe that the future of government will be entirely paper-free. The government of the future will set plans and strategies to ensure the best possible standard of living for people and to save them time and effort. In 2021, we will celebrate the very last paper transaction in Dubai, and Smart Dubai will see to it that we achieve this mission." Now, if you remember a while back, this was probably 2 or 3 years ago, we had covered a story about autonomous drones in Dubai, and it kind of made me chuckle a little bit because in the UAE, they all wear those headdresses. And in the picture, there was a hovering drone and then a sheik standing next to it with his headdress. And I was thinking to myself, that looks like a potential danger to me. Well, listen to this. I just did a quick search on Google this morning, Dubai and self-driving, and check this out. Police in Dubai have recruited self-driving robo-cars that can scan with police drones. There's also a self-driving helicopter taxi coming to Dubai. We covered that one back in June. Police will depend on self-driving robots for security patrols, and we've looked at that story as well. They were kind of scary looking. There was also a self-driving 3D printed bus that they were launching in Dubai as well. And they're going to have self-driving taxis and all kinds of surveillance. And then this one in the airports of Dubai, anyone who wants to go visit, the future of AI surveillance is actually hidden in a virtual airport fish tank. What? The airport has become the perfect testbed for the next generation surveillance techniques like large-scale facial recognition. Japan, France, and the United States have all begun to test AI-powered security systems in already highly surveilled spaces. Dubai Airport is taking this technology one step further, installing a virtual aquarium tunnel studded with 80 hidden cameras that will detect passengers' identities in lieu of security clearance counters, according to a magazine called The National. The aquarium scene is meant to attract the traveler's attention, so the hidden camera behind that particularly colorful fish will have a better angle at the person's face. Look at all these little mind games they're playing with people. The aquarium could one day change to other scenes and display advertisements. The airport hopes to eventually add iris scanning to the tunnel. Passengers will have to register their faces before going through the security using kiosks around the airport. It is unclear whether luggage will be scanned within the tunnel as well. Through a video from the AI, Banyan News shows that passengers walking through the tunnel with a suitcase, and if they're using millimeter wave technology, they probably could scan the contents as well. This facial recognition tunnel give some insight into the psychological tricks, ding, that will corral humans into playing nice with the limitations of machines. And remember, Sophia says she wants humans to like her. That's why she's empathetic and has facial expressions. We discovered that back at MIT when they were playing with Gizmet a long time ago. Modern facial recognition systems need to see a certain amount of a person's face to confidently match it with digital records, and making someone glance in a certain direction as they're taking pictures from every angle. The digital fish exploits the attention of our fleshy, unpredictable brains. The physical environment we live in today are mostly passive. Billboards, bus stop ads, and the department store window displays attempt to attract our attention, but we've built up a resistance, and we hardly even notice them most of the time, or we mute the ads on the TV. But when the direction of our face can give a company data on your identity and your level of interest in product through facial analysis, and they also watch some of your eye tracking movements, it's suddenly more lucrative to capture attention at any cost. Just as attention has been commoditized on the internet, the real world will follow suit. And today it's a digital fish, but tomorrow might be porn. We might see the real world equivalent of the flashing sidebar ad screaming that we are the 1 millionth pedestrian to walk by this sign, and we just need to complete an iris scan to win $1 million. I could see that happening as well. Dubai International Airport's tunnel will be operational in one terminal for the summer of 2018 and then rolled out to the rest of the airports by 2020. What do you think of them apples? I think now they're probably going to have reason to roll that out in Vegas as well. All right, so then I went out to the website about the new smart city that's going to be run and built by robots in Dubai called Neom, the world's most ambitious project. It is DiscoverNeom, NEOM.com, an entirely new land purpose-built for a new way of living. And they break down the project. There's the vision, the foundations, and the development. In the vision, where we live as the future, as we create the future, this is unrivaled in concept, unmatched in intelligence, unconstrained by history, and built on humanity's greatest resource, and that is our imagination. Neom is a new kind of tomorrow in the making, a place on Earth like nothing on Earth, a new blueprint for sustainable life on a scale never before seen, where inventiveness shapes a new, inspiring era for human civilization. Is that really what they are trying to create? I mean, this is just beyond horrifying. So a lot of these things that we've heard and read about Agenda 21 and the coming global community sound like they very well might be coming to fruition. And Dubai is going to be at the center of it. So there is nowhere like this vast site, untouched, diverse terrain, sheltered by mountains and cooled by Red Sea breezes, a temperate Mediterranean climate, 468 kilometers of coastline with beaches and coral reefs, as well as mountains up to 2,500 meters high. They're trying to get you to go there. Oops, I scrolled too far. Hold on. A strategic location on one of the world's most prominent economic arteries will make Neom a global hub for trade, innovation, and knowledge. Neom will operate as an independent economic zone with its own laws, taxes, and regulations, specially created to boost healthy growth and wealth for the region, investors, and residents. And there's a little video that we can't watch anymore online. World-beating quality of life, Neom's unmatched livability and economic prospects will be powered by a profitable economy that will pioneer the future of 9 sectors. 1 will be energy and water, 2 will be mobility, 3 will be biotech, 4 will be food, 5 will be advanced manufacturing, 6 will be media, 7 will be entertainment, 8 will be technological and digital sciences, and 9 will be living as Neom's foundation. Under energy and water, as the sun rises over Neom, it will glint against vast fields of solar panels paired with wind turbines and light up for enormous stretches of energy grid storing power for generations. All of this being sufficient to supply all of Neom and beyond with low-cost regenerative energy. The beams, bridges, and archways of this grand destination will be immaculate, untainted by pollution. Buildings will remain pristine and the air fresh and clear. And Neom scientists, this is like such a brochure, a Neom scientists will pioneer the future of energy production, use, and storage for water, gas, oil, solar, wind, and algae, and a whole new kind of energy that the world has yet to hear of. foreign mobility across the land, air, and sea, NEOM will become a global hub of connectivity. Within its boundaries, it will harness progressive, automated, 100% green transport systems that will glide smoothly and safely in three dimensions and along both superbly efficient and scenic routes. And beyond its borders, it will create brand new connections like an awe-inspiring new bridge that will link Asia with Africa. What? And a bridge whose unifying symbolism will be as strong as its iconic design. For biotech, tomorrow's healthcare will start life here. Oh, I'm sure they will. The world will look to NEOM for next-generation gene therapy, genomics, stem cell research, nanobiology, and bioengineering. Biotech research means no less than a quest for the world's future well-being and fulfillment. And attracting the talent to research, develop, and apply our new knowledge, NEOM will be a nexus for this vital activity. The next is food. How will humanity produce enough fresh food in the desert with no water or create fresh drinking water at sea? Well, don't let that be a surprise. World prosperity is locked behind these questions, and NEOM will find the key. It will lead the way to the state-of-the-art technologies like arid and seawater farming and solar-powered greenhouses, as its vertical urban farms will soar skyward, delivering crisp, fresh produce to its citizens with unprecedented speed and efficiency. Next is advanced manufacturing. There's never been a more exciting time for manufacturing. New materials and methods are breaking open whole worlds of possibility for our future living. Nowhere is a better place to take advantage of these possibilities than NEOM. And you know, behind all of this, they are thinking, cha-ching! This is just, I can't even believe what I'm reading. NEOM won't just innovate in nanotechnology, 3D printing, sensors, Internet of Things devices, electrical vehicles, robotics, and renewables. Starting from scratch means a chance to innovate at the very systems underpinning those innovations of R&D, supply, transport, and infrastructure, and a chance to test out inventions like personalization, fully automated point-to-point transfers, passenger drones, self-learning traffic systems in a live destination setting, and then refine them to perfection. Come to NEOM, be a guinea pig. The next is media. The world's most distinguished directors will look to NEOM's creatives for inspiration. Talent, both established and new, will flood in wanting to be a part of the action, and they will be welcomed with all of the support and infrastructure they need, from production houses to studios that they can produce in, deliver and distribute film, TV, music, video games, and social media. Guys, as I'm reading this, I'm starting to get flashbacks back to Black Mirror. This is beyond frightening. NEOM will seize the world's attention, becoming a media hub, not just for the Middle East, but for the world. And the next is entertainment. NEOM will be the place to be, packed full of sports, performance, and visual art venues, world-renowned restaurants by glittering marinas, water slides, elite shopping experiences that outpace the world's capitals. And NEOM will redefine what urban entertainment means by turning up the dial and raising the scale. With futuristic, record-breaking theme parks, endless natural parkland, and the world's longest or largest garden in the heart of a metropolis, water park with a wave machine where Olympians will perfect their technique, and it will attract tourists from thousands of miles around, and for residents, bring epicness to every day. And I think we're getting near the end. One more, technological and digital sciences. Think of the future, and a few key things spring to mind. Artificial intelligence, virtual reality, smart connected devices that make life effortless, and the Internet of Things. NEOM will innovate on an open source platform, inviting the world's top data scientists to analyze data and innovate, and inventors will enjoy a world's first opportunity to use the destination itself as the test ground for urban innovation. And the very final page, living is NEOM's foundation. What will life be like in NEOM? NEOM is positioned to become an aspirational society that heralds the future of human civilization by offering its inhabitants an idyllic lifestyle set against a backdrop of a community founded on modern architecture, lush green spaces, quality of life, safety, and technology in the service of humanity, paired with excellent economic opportunities. So there you go, guys. DiscoverNeom.com. You know, we read about yesterday or the day before a story out of New Scientist, October 24th, 2017. A smart city in China tracks everyday citizens, and yours could too. Welcome to Neom. And you better believe it. It is going to be the innovation hub, and everything you do and everywhere you go is going to be bagged, tagged, and tracked in one centralized Dubai, Smart Dubai 2021 database and Dubai Pulse. For the past 12 months, we read about this. Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba has been slurping up video feeds, social media data, traffic information, and other data from Hangzhou City for its City Brain project. The stated goal was to improve life in Hangzhou, so it sounds like these guys are on the same path. By letting artificial intelligence process this data and use it to control aspects of everyday urban life. It seems to have worked, and the trial was so successful that the company is now packaging the system for export to other places and eventually the rest of the world. Now, I want to make one correction here. We have talked about Google and the Chinese equivalent of Amazon. No, the Chinese equivalent of Google. Baidu, as I call them, and I'm going to correct, it's Bidu. Sorry about that. I don't know. I tend to read things phonetically. My mother has an accent. So it took me a long time. But it's Bidu. I like to call it, affectionately known as Baidu, but I will try to get that right. Bidu. All right, so now let's talk about some dystopia, if we haven't already. I ran across a story this morning from The Guardian, October 5th, 2017, from an industry insider who says that our minds can be hijacked. Tech insiders fear a smartphone dystopia. Of course, no, it's not loading. Google, Twitter, and Facebook workers who helped make the technology so addictive. We've talked about that addiction to the dangling dopamine carrot of technology, are disconnecting themselves from the internet. And take it from someone who's been almost 30 years in the industry. We helped build the pipes that are running the infrastructure now, and a lot of us are backing up the truck going, whoa, Chuck, we don't want to go there. I know I don't want to be living in Neom or Smart City 2021, that's for sure. I like my privacy, and I don't like to be bagged, tagged, and tracked. Paul Lewis reports on the Silicon Valley refuseniks alarmed by a race for human attention. Justin Rosenstein had tweaked his laptop operating system to block Reddit and banned himself from Snapchat, which he compares to heroin. We read about how they had looked at some of the interactions in the brain with heroin and how it was pushing the exact same buttons when you get a like or you tinker around on your computer. And he's imposed limits on his use of Facebook. But even that wasn't enough. In August, the 34-year-old tech executive took an even more radical step to restrict his use of social media and other addictive technologies. Rosenstein purchased a new iPhone and instructed his assistant to set up a parental control feature that prevented him from downloading any applications. And he was particularly aware of the allure of Facebook's likes, which he describes as the bright dings of pseudo-pleasure that can be as hollow as they are seductive. And Rosenstein should know he was the Facebook engineer who created the like button in the first place. Ding! A decade after he stayed up all night coding a prototype of what was then called an awesome button, Rosenstein belongs to a small but growing band of Silicon Valley heretics. So is that what I am? Who complain about the rise of the so-called attention economy that is an internet shaped around the demands of an advertising economy. those refuseniks, and that would be the resistant consumers, are rarely founders or chief executives who have little incentive to deviate from the mantra that their companies are making a better world, the world a better place. But instead, they tend to have worked a rung or two down the corporate ladder as designers, engineers, ding, and product managers who, like Rosenstein several years ago, put in place the building blocks of a digital world from which they are now trying to disentangle themselves. It is very common, Rosenstein says, for humans to develop things with the best of intentions and then for them to have unintended negative consequences. Just like I've said many times, and probably the biggest premise of the show, Rosenstein, who also helped create GChat during his stint at Google, so he not only worked for Facebook, but he worked for Google as well, now leads a San Francisco-based company that improves office productivity and appears concerned about the psychological effects on people, research shows, who touch, swipe, or tap their phones 2,617 times a day. And there is growing concern that as well as addicting users, technology is also contributing toward a so-called, quote, continuous partial attention, which is severely limiting people's ability to focus. And we read a study on that before, and potentially lowering IQs. And that would be just fine because the robots are going to come take all the jobs and all the thinking. One recent study showed that a mere presence of a smartphone damages cognitive capacity, and even when the device is turned off, everyone is distracted, says Rosenstein, all of the time. And that's another thing that I've been noticing in Black Mirror. I think I've watched 5 episodes now, but in just about all of those episodes, everyone is so addicted to their device or always filming, and that's what it is coming to. And I feel very bad. You know, I got to tell you, I'm really kind of having an ethical dilemma inside about my daughter, and they just entered middle school, and one of the new things that they were trying this year is that they gave, and for a long time I've limited computer interaction for my daughter. You know, every once in a while we'd let her go play, and she learned to program a little bit with Scratch and make a Lego robot and a what are those little computer components called? Oh, I don't remember. The little plug-and-play robot components that have the Raspberry Pi. That's what they are. She and my husband built a little Raspberry Pi robot, and she helped learn to program, and they came up with all kinds of little things. But only for educational purposes, I never let her go out and play endlessly on the device. And one of the reasons was that we found very early on with the iPad that every time she touched that iPad, we had disciplinary problems afterwards. So I started doing a lot of research on this, and I have quite a few earlier shows. If you search dopamine, I think dopamine I put in all of the titles for those shows. There's a lot of links, and I talked a lot about some of the psychological research that has been published on what it does to children's minds. Well, I'm very upset now because as of part of middle school, this year they decided to give all incoming middle school students notebook computers. And from the very beginning, I said, no way, I'm going to go talk to the school. I don't want her to have a computer because it always causes issues. And I have to tell you that this school year has probably been the most challenging yet. From morning until evening, it is disciplinary issues, one after the other after the other. And having any type of time management skill doesn't even happen. And every night, it's that I only have a little bit of homework, and then it takes until 9 o'clock, and we're still not done. And I'm like, but I thought you said you only had 3 questions. It's because she cannot control herself, because I think it causes problems with self-regulation. She cannot control herself to not go elsewhere beyond just working on writing her paragraph or whatever she has to do. And they've put all the homework online. They put all the assignments online. So there's really no way to get your kid off of the machine. This is now how they're building this new digital education. So it's, I got to tell you, this has been a very trying time for me. And then add to that all my health issues and these brain scans and all this other crap I've been going through. 2017 has probably been one of my most challenging years yet. All right, so anyway, there is growing concern that as well as addicting users, and now they are sucking in the children, technology is contributing toward a so-called continuous partial attention, which is severely limiting people's ability to focus and potentially lowering their IQs. One recent study showed that a mere presence of a smartphone damages your cognitive capacity. But those concerns are trivial compared to the devastating impact upon the political system that some of Rosenstein's peers believe can be attributed to the rise of social media and the attention-based market that drives it. And of course, now they're going to use the election of Donald Trump. It's all about the social media and the puny humans who were swayed by it. Drawing a straight line between addiction to social media and political earthquakes like Brexit and the rise of Donald Trump, ding, they contend that digital forces have completely upended the political system, so let's put an AI in charge, and left unchecked could even render democracy as we know it obsolete. So we can't leave decisions up to puny human brains who are constantly distracted by their devices. In 2007, Rosenstein was a small group of Facebook employees who decided to create a path of least resistance, a single click to send little bits of positivity across the platform. Facebook's like feature, Rosenstein said, was wildly successful. Engagement soared as people enjoyed the short-term boost that they got from giving or receiving social affirmation, while Facebook harvested valuable data about preferences of users that could then be sold to advertisers. The idea was soon copied by Twitter with its heart-shaped like and previously star-shaped favorites, Instagram, and countless other apps and websites. But it was Rosenstein's colleague, Leah Perlman, then a project manager at Facebook and on the team that created the Facebook like, who announced the feature in a 2009 blog post and now 35 and an illustrator. Perlman confirmed via email that she, too, has grown disaffected with Facebook likes and other addictive feedback loops. She has installed a web browser plugin to eradicate her Facebook newsfeed and hired a social media manager to monitor her Facebook page so that she doesn't have to. One reason I think it is particularly important for us to talk about this now is that we may be the very last generation who can remember life before. And how many times have I told you guys that? I really think he's a little bit younger than me. He's in his 30s. But I really think that Generation X, and he says he's in his 30s. I'm in my 40s. But even 70s, grew up in the 70s or the 80s. I got my first Commodore 64 in 1982. Before that, we didn't know any better. You know, we got Atari in 1978, I believe, but most people didn't have it then. It may or may not be relevant that Rosenstein and Perlman and most of the tech insiders questioning today's attention economy are in their 30s or even their 40s, members of the last generation that will be able to remember a world in which telephones were plugged into the walls. And guess what? I still have a landline. It is revealing that many, even though it cost me a fortune and they keep raising the taxes every single month, it is revealing that many of these younger technologists are weaning themselves off of their own products and sending their children to elite Silicon Valley schools where iPhones, iPads, and even laptops are banned. Yeah, we don't have any of those here. And they appear to be abiding by a Biggie Small lyric from their own youth, that the perils of dealing crack cocaine. Never get high on your own supply. That was after my time. One morning in April 2017, designers, programmers, and tech entrepreneurs from across the world gathered at a conference center on the shores of San Francisco Bay. They had each paid up to $1,700 to learn how to manipulate people into the habitual use of their products on a course curated by conference organizer Nir Eyal. Eyal, 39, the author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, has spent several years conducting consulting for the tech industry, teaching techniques he developed by closely studying how Silicon Valley giants operate. The technologies we use have turned into compulsions, if not full-fledged addictions, Eyal writes. And it is the impulse, and this is exactly sucking you into the machine. This is what I've been warning about, guys. Don't let it suck you in. It is your impulse to check message notification. It's the pull to YouTube. Facebook and Twitter and visiting just for a few minutes, only to find yourself still tapping and scrolling an hour later. And none of this is an accident, he writes. It is all just as their designers intended. And in one of the studies that I read, children are even more susceptible to dopamine than adults are. And that is why giving middle school students a laptop is even more dangerous. Not only is it sucking them into the machine, but it is highly addicting them to the machine. He explains the subtle psychological tricks that can be used to make people develop habits, such as varying the rewards that people receive to create a craving, or exploiting negative emotions that can act as triggers. Feelings of boredom, loneliness, frustration, confusion, and indecisiveness often instigate a slight pain or irritation and prompt an almost instantaneous and often mindless action to quell those negative sensations. Attendees of the 2017 Habit Summit might have been surprised when E.L. walked on stage and announced that this year's keynote speech was about something a little different. He wanted to address the growing concerns that technological manipulation was somehow harmful or immoral. Oh, no, nothing immoral about that. He told his audience that they should be careful not to abuse pervasive design and be wary of crossing the line into coercion. He was defensive about the techniques he teaches and dismissive to those who compare tech addiction to drugs. We are not freebasing Facebook and injecting Instagram here, he said. He flashed up a slide of a shelf filled with sugary baked goods, just as we shouldn't blame the baker for making such delicious treats. And it is that same dopamine button that sugary treats acts upon. We can't blame the tech makers for making their products so good that we want to use them, he says. And of course, that is what most tech companies will do. And frankly, do we want it another way? Without irony, Erol finished his talk with some personal tips for resisting the lure of technology. He told his audience he uses a Chrome extension called DF YouTube, which scrubs out a lot of those external triggers. And he writes about it in his book and recommends an app called Pocket Points that rewards you for staying off your phone when you need to focus. I think I need to get my daughter on that. Finally, Eyal confided the lengths that he goes to protect his own family, and I think my husband should read the story. He has installed in his house an outlet timer connected to a router that cuts off access to the internet at a set time every single day. Maybe I should split off my internet for a separate feed into the radio network. The idea is to remember that we are not powerless. We are also in control. But are we? And if people who built these technologies are taking such radical steps to wean themselves free, can the rest of us be reasonably expected to exercise our own free will? And I think that we won't be. I think that this is as addictive as crack cocaine, if you want to know my honest opinion. And not according to Tristan Harris, the 33-year-old former Google employee turned vocal critic of the tech industry. All of us are jacked into the system, he says, and all of our minds can be hijacked. Our choices are not as free as we think that they are. Harris, who has been branded, quote, the closest thing Silicon Valley has to a conscience, insists that billions of people have little choice over whether they use these new ubiquitous technologies, and are largely unaware of the invisible ways in which small numbers of people in Silicon Valley are now shaping their lives. And you also got to wonder about the ethics of those people. And that is where this show comes in. I don't trust any of them as far as I can throw them. And I don't think that this is being done for your best interest. A graduate of Stanford University, Harris studied under B.J. Fogg, who is a behavioral psychologist revered in tech circles, for mastering the ways in which technological design can be used to persuade people. And many of his students, including IL, have gone on to prosperous careers in Silicon Valley. And that's like user interface development. You got to make it user-friendly and happy with big, pretty colors to get people to interact, and then give them a dopamine dose to bring them back. Harris is the student who went rogue, and I like being one of those. A whistleblower of sorts, and he is lifting the curtain on the vast powers accumulated by technology companies and the ways that they use them for influence. A handful of people working at a handful of technology companies, through their choices, will steer what a billion people are thinking today, he said at a recent tech talk in Vancouver. And I don't know what a more urgent problem is than this, he says. It is changing our democracy. It is changing our ability to have the conversations and relationships that we want with each other. Harris went public, giving talks, writing papers, meeting lawmakers, and campaigning for reform after 3 years struggling to effect change inside of Google's Mountain View headquarters. And it all began in 2013. So I actually started before him when he was working as a product manager at Google and circulating a thought-provoking memo called A Call to Minimize Distraction and Respect Users' Attention to 10 Close Colleagues. It struck a chord, spreading to some 5,000 Google employees, including senior executives, who rewarded Harris with an impressive-sounding new job. He was going to be Google's in-house design ethicist and product philosopher. Looking back, Harris sees that he was promoted into a marginal role. He didn't have the social support structure at all, he says. And he still adds that I got to sit in a corner and think and read and understand. And that's what they do with you when you open your mouth. He explored how LinkedIn exploits a need for social reciprocity and to widen its network, and how YouTube and Netflix autoplay videos and next episodes deprive user of a choice about whether or not they want to keep watching. And I always turn off that autoplay on YouTube. And how Snapchat created its addictive Snapstreaks feature, encouraging near constant communication between its mostly teenage users. The techniques that these companies use are not always generic. They can be algorithmically tailored to each person. An internal Facebook report leaked this year, for example, revealed that the company can identify when teens feel insecure, worthless, and need a confidence boost. Remember Regina Duggan just stepped down from Facebook, but those would be the tentacles of DARPA into Facebook's secretive Building 8. And they were talking about reading minds to be able to type and interact with Facebook. The techniques that these companies use are not always generic. They can be algorithmically tailored to each person. Such granular information, Harris adds, is, quote, a perfect model of what buttons you can push in a particular person. Tech companies can exploit such vulnerabilities to keep people hooked, manipulating, for example, when people receive likes for their posts, ensuring that then they arrive when an individual is likely to feel vulnerable or in need of approval or maybe just bored. And at the very same techniques can be sold to the highest bidder. There are no ethics, he says. A company paying Facebook to use its levers of persuasion could be a car business targeting tailored advertisements to different types of users who want a new vehicle. Or it could be a Moscow-based troll farm seeking to turn voters, ding, into a swing county in Wisconsin. Of course, they're never going to let that drop. Harris believes that tech companies never deliberately set out to make their products addictive. They were responding to the incentives of an advertising economy, experimenting with techniques that might capture people's attention, even stumbling across highly effective design by accident. A friend at Facebook told Harris that designers initially decided the notification icon, which alerts people to new activities such as friend requests or likes, should be blue. And it fit Facebook's style and the thinking when it would appear subtle and innocuous. But no one uses it, says Harris, so then they switched to red, and of course everybody used it, and the red icon is now everywhere. When a smartphone user glances at their phone dozens or even hundreds of times a day, they are confronted with a small red dot beside their app pleading to be tapped. Red is a trigger color, says Harris, and that is why it is used as an alarm signal. The most seductive design, Harris explains, exploits the same psychological susceptibility that makes puny humans into gamblers and makes it so compulsive. And again, gambling is also a dopamine button. Like I said, we've done shows on this before. I can't believe that someone is actually echoing a lot of my own research. And that would be variable rewards. When we tap those apps with red icons, we don't know whether or not we'll be discovering an interesting email with avalanches of likes or nothing at all. It is the possibility of disappointment that makes it so compulsive, as well as the dopamine button. But it's this that explains how the pull-to-refresh mechanism, where users swipe down, pause, and wait to see what content appears, rapidly became one of the most addictive and ubiquitous design features in modern technology. Each time you're swiping down, it's like a slot machine, says Harris, and you don't know what is coming next. Sometimes it's a beautiful photo, and sometimes it is just an ad. The designers who created the pull-to-refresh mechanism, first used to update Twitter feeds, is Lauren Brichter, a widely admired in the app-building community for his sleek and intuitive designs. Now 32, Brichter says that he never intended to design to be addictive, but would not dispute the slot machine comparison. I agree 100%, he says. I have two kids now, and I regret every minute that I'm not paying attention to them because my smartphone has sucked me in. Brichter created the feature in 2009 for Tweety, his startup, mainly because he could not find anywhere to fit the refresh button into his application. Holding and dragging down the feed to update seemed at the time nothing more than a cute and clever fix, but Twitter acquired Tweety the following year, integrating pull-to-refresh into his own app. Or into its own app. And since then, design has become one of the most widely emulated features in applications. The downward pull action for hundreds of millions of people as intuitive as scratching an itch. Victor says that he is puzzled by the longevity of the feature. In an era of push notification technologies, apps can automatically update content without being nudged by the user. It could be easily retired, he said, but instead it appears to serve a psychological function. After all, slot machines would be far less addictive if gamblers didn't have to pull the lever or push the button themselves. Victor prefers another comparison. It is like the redundant closed door button in some elevators with automatically closing doors. People just like to push that button, and I always do when I'm in there. All of which has left Brichter, who put his design work on the back burner while he focuses on building a house in New Jersey, questioning his legacy. I have spent many hours and weeks and months and years thinking about whether anything I have done has made a net positive impact on society or humanity at all, he says. He's blocked certain websites, turned off push notifications, restricted his use of the Telegram app to message only with his wife and two close friends, and tried to wean himself off of Twitter. I still waste time on it, he confesses, just reading stupid news about stuff I already know. And he charges his phone in the kitchen, plugging it in at 7 p.m. and not touching it again until the next meeting.